and thanks to the Tata Institute for hosting this Strings 2001 meeting. Can you hear me at the back, by the way? Yes? So, you've just heard from David Gross a explanation of how string theory endeavors to unify the forces of nature. And incidentally, for those who want to probe in more depth about this subject, I would recommend Brian Greene's book, The Elegant Universe. Now, since you've heard about the unification of the forces so far this afternoon, I'm going to do something a little bit different and talk about the unification of the ideas. Now, if we're going to discuss this, we have to start somewhere. And so I'm going to begin with a problem that actually was my prime interest when I was a graduate student in the mid-70s. It's the classic and not fully solved problem of quark confinement. As David reminded us at the beginning, near the beginning of his lecture, protons and neutrons and other strongly interacting particles, such as pions, are made out of smaller objects that we call quarks, and also anti-quarks and gluons. But there's something extremely strange about this, which is that experimentally we never observe an isolated quark. It's believed that if you take one of these particles, for example, a pion, which is made of a quark and antiquark, and you try to separate the quark from the antiquark, it's believed that the energy required to separate them grows linearly as you separate them because of the formation of something called a color electric flux tube between them. We don't understand these color electric flux tubes too well, but we can see them forming in computer simulations, in large-scale computer calculations, and we can also infer their formation from accelerator experiments. So the phenomenon is believed to be a little bit like something called the Meissner effect in a superconductor. Some of you may have seen in a science fair a common demonstration where there's a piece of metal that's superconducting, perhaps it's kept in liquid nitrogen or something, and floating above it. Okay, floating above it is a magnet which levitates because of the fact that the magnetic field that's created by this magnet can't penetrate the superconductor. So that's a phenomenon that you can see with your eyes in a science fair. Here, the distances are so small that we can't see it so easily, but we believe what happens is that the vacuum expels the electric flux that is created by quarks. But because quarks do create this flux, what happens is that between the quark and the antiquark is a thin region called the electric flux tube that the flux penetrates. As you separate the quark from the antiquark, this region grows, and so more and more energy is required to create a longer and longer color flux tube. Well, we've had a theoretical framework for analyzing quark confinement and whether these flux tubes form when you try to separate quarks and antiquarks for over a quarter of a century, but the mathematics involved in understanding it has been too difficult. There's been for a long time a precise mathematical formulation. You're supposed to contemplate a quark running around a loop C in space-time. I've schematically plotted space-time with space running vertically and time horizontally. And you should show that the probability amplitude, the quantum mechanical probability amplitude, for a quark to propagate around a very large loop in space-time is extremely small, proportional to the exponential of minus the area of the loop. In this form, the hypothesis of quark confinement has been extensively tested in computer simulations since the late 70s. And this, together with ordinary experiments, gives us confidence that it is correct. But we still don't really understand what's going on. Well, the hypothesis of quark confinement, according to which if you try to separate a quark from an antiquark, you run up with this, you create this rather strange and little understood color electric flux tube between them. It has an obvious analogy with string theory, where in the case of open strings, one interprets a particle as a string with charges at the two ends. So in the string theory, as it was formulated around 1970, a meson was supposed to be made from a charge and an anti-charge connected by a string. And now, then physicists a few years later developed a more refined theory where instead of a string, there was a color electric flux tube forming between them. So these are slightly different pictures, but the analogy between them is obvious. So string theory, in fact, originated in the late 60s, not with the goal of explaining all the forces, as David Gross explained in his talk, but with the goal of understanding the strong interactions, the nuclear forces. And to the extent that the discovery of string theory in the 60s wasn't a historical accident, it was discovered because of the analogy between these two pictures. But when physicists probed more deeply into string theory in the late 60s and early 70s, they seemed to learn that string theory was very different from the world of these strong interactions or nuclear forces. One difference was that when probing more deeply into the physics of an open string, starting with an open string and letting it evolve in time, which I'll let run down, it might loop around and split off a little piece, which is a closed string, a closed loop of string. So it turned out that closed strings are inescapable. And when closed strings were studied more precisely, it turned out that the closed strings describe gravity, that is, a quantum theory that looks like Einstein's general relativity at long distances with extremely tiny corrections. So this was a very surprising discovery, and dozens, probably hundreds of papers were written in the early 70s in an attempt to avoid reaching the conclusion that string theory forced gravity upon us. I say upon us loosely, as I wasn't really in the field at the time, but collectively, as a scientific community, closed strings force gravity upon us. So the fact that string theory requires quantum gravity made it seem unsuitable as a theory of the strong interactions, which makes perfect sense as something you study in the laboratory without having to worry about gravity that works on astronomical distances. So it sort of disqualified string theory as a theory of the strong interactions, or so it seemed at first. But it's a very striking fact, and it's been our main motivation for work on string theory since the mid-70s. What makes this fact so striking is that a theory of quantum gravity is certainly needed, and as David alluded to, the conventional framework of quantum field theory actually simply doesn't work in the presence of gravity. It makes gravity impossible. So physicists were trying to discover a theory of the strong interactions, and it didn't work, but instead they stumbled upon a theory that had the potential to describe quantum gravity. So string theory didn't quite work as a theory of the strong interactions, yet it had a striking analogy with the problem of quark confinement. And as this problem of quark confinement has continued to not be properly understood, we can do large-scale computer simulations, but that doesn't leave us feeling we really understand what's going on. Because of the fact that the behavior of quarks has not been understood, its analogy with string theory has continued to the present day to fascinate many physicists. Now, I've stressed the quark confinement because it's the easiest problem to briefly explain, but the fact is that in quantum chromodynamics, which is our theory of the nuclear forces, we can compute a lot using asymptotic freedom, as it's called. But this leaves many of the most fundamental issues out of reach. I've illustrated quark confinement, which is the sharpest mystery, but many other puzzles remain unsolved in this theory, such as computing the particle masses. Now, there's really only been one plausible suggestion, in my opinion, about how we could ever hope to compute the particle masses. This is an old idea of a Hooft, more than a quarter century old, that says that we should imagine that the number of colors, which in the real strong interactions is 3, should be replaced by a larger number, n. And then at Hooft suggested that in the limit that n would be large, we would be able to understand how quarks really behave. He showed that in the large n limit, the graphs that describe the particle interactions are the ones that can be drawn on the surface of a sphere, and that the corrections could be systematically organized according to the topology of a Riemann surface on which the Feynman graph should be drawn. So, on the basis of this, Hooft was led to conjecture that the theory we use to describe the quarks and gluons, which is the four-dimensional quantum gauge theory, is actually a string theory with 1 over n as the string coupling constant. And there are a number of features of the observed nuclear forces that suggest that this is on the right track. But there are equally many things that make it look hopeless. What kind of string theory can this possibly be? It's supposed to be a theory without gravity because we want to describe the nuclear forces in ordinary flat four-dimensional space-time. But as I've already told you, string theory as we know it forces quantum gravity upon us. That's good, but not for describing ordinary quarks and gluons. And moreover, string theory starts in 10 dimensions, which may give room to unify the forces, but doesn't seem likely to give us a string theory that would be equivalent to ordinary four-dimensional gauge theory. Now, 26 or so years after Hooft's original suggestion, we still don't really have an answer, and that's because summing the Feynman diagrams that can be drawn on the surface of a sphere is hopelessly difficult. The effort has given us a lot of deep results about both mathematics and physics, and of these I won't try to explain all, but I will try to explain those results about the gauge theory that come closest to the goal of understanding gauge theory as a string theory. Now, before going on, I should add the bad news, which is that, like other known approaches to quark confinement, the insights that I'll be explaining explain confinement in a modified or slightly simplified version of the theory and don't yet give a quantitative approach to the real theory of strong interactions, or QCD. So our goal is going to be to explain something about how physicists have gotten new insights about the analogy between string theory and the behavior of the quarks that make up protons and neutrons. But before going back to that, I have to tell you about a few other things in the spirit of today's talk, which is the unification of the ideas. So I'll have to tell you a few things in particular about black holes. Well, the simplest black hole is the Schwarzschild solution of general relativity. I've written the metric here, and some of you will be familiar with it, but never mind if you're not. But one thing which you do all know about black holes is that classically, a black hole is an object whose gravity is so strong that it absorbs anything that comes near, and nothing can escape from it. So classically, a black hole absorbs and does not emit. Quantum mechanically, that's impossible, because absorption is described by a matrix element of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is what's called a Hermitian operator. So if it's got a matrix element for absorption, it has a complex conjugate matrix element for emission. So quantum mechanically, there can't be an object that absorbs and doesn't emit. At this level, the problem was solved in 1974 by Stephen Hawking, who showed that quantum mechanically, a black hole does emit. In fact, it emits approximately thermal radiation at a temperature, which is given by this beautiful formula here, in terms of the fundamental constants that David Gross stressed, Planck's constant, the speed of light, and Newton's constant, along with the mass of the black hole. Now, this temperature is fantastically small for an ordinary astrophysical black hole with, for example, the mass of a star. Although it would be a large temperature for a black hole with a microscopic mass. A black hole with the mass of a cup of water would be extremely hot because But a black, because of the huge mass of a star, a black hole with an astronomical mass is extremely cold. Associated with this temperature, according to the second law of thermodynamics, is an entropy. And the entropy of a black hole can be expressed in this form in terms of the size A of the surface of the black hole together with those fundamental constants, Planck's constant, the speed of light, and Newton's constant, capital G. This entropy of the black hole is extremely big, much bigger than any entropy that's ordinarily encountered in physics. For example, a black hole with the mass of a sun would have an entropy many, many, many times bigger than the entropy of the actual sun. Well, entropy, I remind you, is a measure of randomness. In the rest of physics, entropy is the logarithm of the number of quantum states. So Hawking's discovery of black hole radiation really raised many new questions, which I'll try to classify in two groups of questions. I'll call the first class of questions static and the second class dynamic. The basic static question has to do with what the entropy of a black hole means. In the rest of physics, the entropy is the logarithm of the number of quantum states. If the Bekenstein-Hawking black hole entropy, which was inferred from a very unusual type of macroscopic reasoning, is like every other entropy we've met, then a black hole of mass m has a very large number of quantum states, a ridiculously large number, given roughly by this formula, where m Planck is the Planck mass and m black hole is the mass of a black hole. So for a solar mass black hole, this exponent would be roughly 10 to the 76. The exponential of 10 to the 76 is much bigger than any number one usually meets in science. It's a startlingly big number, but what makes it so startlingly big is especially that this quantum answer seems like the opposite of the classical answer. Classically, a black hole is the simplest and purest object we know in the universe, except that we only know them theoretically and from rather indirect astronomical observations. But according to theory, a classical black hole is described by its mass and one or two other numbers like its electric charge and spin. So classically, a black hole is a very pure object that is completely described by giving a few numbers. But quantum mechanically, if this black hole entropy is like every other entropy in nature, then to describe the state of a black hole requires giving an absurdly large amount of information, much more than all the information stored in all the books in our planet. I won't say all the books in the universe because I don't know quite how many galaxies and civilizations are out there. I think I could safely say much more than all the books in all the libraries and galaxies that are presently visible to us. So we've got this absurdly large number that's supposed to represent the amount of information it takes to describe a black hole quantum mechanically. Well, if this is really right, I mean, can we demonstrate that this is right? Can we do some kind of microscopic calculation where we'll actually describe the quantum states of a black hole and count them and get that ludicrous-looking answer that was found by Bekenstein and Hawking? Well, for this, we need a quantum theory of gravity because the question combines quantum mechanics, since we're talking about quantum states, with gravity, since we're talking about black holes, whose existence depends on gravity. So we need a quantum theory of gravity, and therefore string theory is our only candidate, at least at present. Even in string theory, the question was out of reach for the first two decades. But in 1995, we learned about, beginning with a famous paper by Joe Polchinski on what are called Ramon-Ramon charges, we learned of the importance of a new class of non-perturbative objects in string theory, which are called D-brains. And these change the picture. I don't have time to really explain what a D-brain is, but I'm going to give a cartoon version just in this one transparency. So I start with type 2 string theory, which was believed until 1995 to only have closed loops of string like the one I've drawn here. But like all string theories, this one has gravity, and therefore it has black holes. So we at least have to allow for the possibility that a black hole could swallow a string, or it might swallow just a piece of a string. So we at least have to allow a string that ends on a black hole horizon. So we could think that type 2 string theory only had black strings with no ends, but at least we have to imagine that the string can end on the horizon of a black hole. Now we're going to make a leap of faith. This isn't something I'll prove. And imagine that we can have two different black holes connected by a string. I can't prove this is allowed in the theory from the type of reasoning I'm giving you today, but the reason for suspecting it is that any small piece of this picture looks like a piece of this picture. So there's a small piece of that picture and it looks like a small piece of this one. And since the laws of nature are local, if this situation is allowed, that suggests this one is allowed. Well, let's assume we're allowed to have this configuration. And now, according to Stephen Hawking, black holes evaporate and shrink. They shrink as they lose mass because of the radiation they emit. So Hawking said that black holes would evaporate down to nothing. But once we've got a string ending on a black hole, it can't evaporate down to nothing because then we'd have a string ending in the vacuum. And we already said that type 2 strings in vacuum don't end on anything. So it must be that this kind of black hole evaporates down to not down to nothing, but down to some small elementary object on which a string can end. And that object is called the D-brain. And what Polchinski showed in his famous paper is that the D-brain carries an electric charge, which is what prevents this kind of black hole from completely evaporating. So that's the best I can do to explain how physicists, well, this isn't precisely in any case how physicists discovered D-brains, but this is the best I can do to rationalize the idea that these objects might exist in a brief period. Now, there's a very unusual property that D-brains have, which is suggestive of some of those revolutions that David Gross was hinting at the end of his talk. D-brains have a very strange property that their positions are measured by matrices. A single D-brain has position coordinates like any other particle. So, for example, if we're in three dimensions, you would give the position of a D-brain by saying how high it is above sea level, as well as its latitude and longitude. Three coordinates. We're in Mumbai here at the Tata Institute. That specifies three positions, which you can think of as longitude, latitude, and elevation. So a single D-brain has its position measured by numbers, but a system of n identical D-brains, their positions are not measured by numbers, but by more abstract objects called matrices, n by n matrices if you have n D-brains. Now, this is a little like what happened in quantum mechanics. Classically, position and velocity are measured by numbers, but in quantum mechanics, they became non-commuting matrices. So, but in quantum mechanics, position by itself is still measured by numbers, so that ordinary space is measured in the same way. Here in D-brain physics, the more abstract type of measurement affects space by itself. We have a story similar to quantum mechanics. If position matrices commute, they can be simultaneously diagonalized, and then their eigenvalues can be interpreted as positions. But in general, the D-brain matrices don't commute. And this is a kind of stringy version of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is that momentum and position don't commute. Here, the different components of the position don't commute. It's a new kind of uncertainty, but not yet put in such a nice form as the Heisenberg principle. But although we don't really understand where it came from, we've stumbled upon it. That's pretty much the way we've discovered everything that's known in string theory. So we've got these n by n position matrices with SUN gauge symmetry, SUN symmetry. And the physics of this is gauge theory, a lot like the type of theory that we use to describe quarks and gluons. So now, our goal was to unify the ideas today. So we're going to be describing everything by more or less the same ideas. We had quarks that are governed by gauge theories. And now, by discovering these D-brains, physicists learned that there are likewise, you can make black holes that can be described by gauge theory. So in fact, if you make a black hole out of ND brains, you'll have an SUN gauge theory describing this black hole, a lot like the gauge theories that are used to describe protons and neutrons. Now, if we want to calculate the entropy of the black hole, to count the quantum states and compare it to Hawking's semi-classical formula, it won't do to take 7 D brains or 16 of them or 2. We need to take a very large number of D brains. And the reason is that the semi-classical formula is only valid for a black hole of large mass, a black hole made from many particles. So we take SUN gauge theory for large N, and that's what we should use to try to understand the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And that, in fact, was one of the milestones in string theory just a few years ago, when a large N gauge theory was used to count the microscopic states of a black hole, certain kinds of black holes, recovering the formula that had been known from a semi-classical point of view. Well, it's very interesting that large N was required, because large N is also the limit, according to Hooft, that we're supposed to take in order to understand the unsolved mysteries of the strong interactions, such as why quarks are confined, how color flux tubes form between quarks and antiquarks. So the same large N gauge theory that was used to study black holes is very similar to what we're supposed to use to understand the strong interactions. But to calculate the entropy, Strominger and Waffa did not have to grapple with the hard dynamics of large N. They were able to use more elementary properties, which incidentally were closely related to a lot of the algebraic geometry, which is one of the central subjects in the math school here at the Tata Institute. But they didn't need the hard dynamics, the hard physics of large N. But still, their work raised a question. Would deeper results about large N gauge theory, perhaps results closer to what we want to understand quark confinement, lead to deeper insights about black holes? To this question, too, at least a partial answer has emerged in the last few years. But to explain this, I now need to tell you about the deeper mysteries of black holes. I told you, you may recall, that Hawking's discovery of the black hole radiation left open two kinds of questions. There were the static ones, which I boiled down to the question of counting black hole states and understanding the entropy, and there are the dynamic questions about black holes, to which we will now turn. The dynamic question about a black hole is how can one describe quantum mechanically the absorption and emission of matter by a black hole? Or, if you wish, the formation and eventual evaporation of a black hole in the real world. At first sight, you run into a lot of contradictions, and it seems that ordinary laws of physics cannot apply in the formation and evaporation of a black hole. For example, we could make a black hole from protons and neutrons, which are called baryons, or we could use their antiparticles, antibaryons. Ordinary physical processes preserve the number of baryons or antibaryons. But black hole formation and evaporation can't preserve this number, because if you make a black hole out of baryons, then as Hawking pointed out, you won't get back the baryons in the Hawking radiation. That's because almost all the radiation is emitted while the temperature is so tiny that you can't emit either baryons or antibaryons in any significant number. At first, it seemed that this meant that black hole formation and evaporation is different from ordinary physical processes, since it violated baryon number conservation while known physical processes conserved it. But in the late 70s, as a byproduct of attempts to unify the strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions, most particle physicists came to suspect that ordinary physical processes also don't conserve baryon number at a rate which would be small under ordinary conditions, but large under the near the horizon of a black hole. Well, there are other ways to attempt to prove that black hole formation and evaporation doesn't obey the general laws of quantum mechanics. For example, if one forms a black hole from matter in a definite quantum state, and if it decays by Hawking radiation, which is purely thermal, then the detailed information about the initial state is lost. This might be taken to imply that black hole evolution is not governed by quantum mechanics. But if the Hawking radiation is only approximately and apparently thermal, it might be that the details of the initial state are encoded in very subtle correlations among the particles in the outgoing Hawking radiation. Just as the radiation from an ordinary star is apparently more or less thermal, even though the evolution of the star is completely governed by quantum mechanics. So if we think this way, we can imagine that black hole formation and evaporation might be a limiting case with many particles of ordinary particle interactions, obeying the same rules as an elementary process. Here, with time running vertically and space horizontally, I've sketched some elementary processes with two particles going in and two out, or with two going in and three out. And those we can calculate using textbook recipes of Feynman diagrams. But if we had 10 to the 57 particles coming in, as for a star, and maybe 10 to the 80 coming out in the future of the Hawking radiation, then perhaps the rules are the same, the concepts are the same in principle, but it would describe the formation and evaporation of a black hole. But we've got a little bit of a problem, which is that if we believe that the information about the initial state does somehow come out in the Hawking radiation, we can't also believe that during the black hole's lifetime, the detailed information about its quantum state is hidden behind the horizon and unable to influence the outside world. Instead, Hooft and then Susskind proposed a holographic hypothesis extending earlier ideas about black holes. And their rather radical idea is that there is some description of nature in which all the information about the physical state of a system with gravity in a region that I've called capital omega is actually stored by a suitable set of variables on the boundary of that region. So they want to compare gravity in a large region of space with some unspecified theory on the boundary. And one of the important things is that the boundary theory is supposed to be a theory without gravity. So this, I'm afraid I don't have time to do justice to just how radical this idea is. This radical idea really contradicts our notions of locality in physics. Usually we think that in a large volume V, whose surface area I'll call A, we think that the entropy, the counting of the number of degrees of freedom, is proportional to the volume. But in saying that that everything can be described by a theory on the surface, that means that the entropy would really be bounded by the area, not by the volume. And the area is much less in case the volume is very large. Now, it's hard to imagine in any conventional terms how holography could be true, but if it is true, it gives an answer of principle about black holes, because it says that there always is a description in which all the quantum information is stored outside the black hole horizon. Here I've sketched a black hole, and the solid blue line is meant to be its horizon. And now we think of the black hole with its horizon as the region, which I called capital omega, such that all details of what's inside it are stored by some kind of theory on the surface. So I've drawn a dotted line, and we imagine that the information is somehow stored there. Well, if that's true, then the information hasn't really collapsed inside the black hole, and in principle it might escape in subtle correlations in the Hawking radiation. There's a semi-classical reason to suspect something like this. If you look at Einstein's theory, you discover that an observer outside a black hole never actually sees anything fall into the hole. As a as an object falls into the hole, it appears to slow down and get frozen and stuck on the horizon. It looks redder and redder and dimmer to the outside observer, but the outside observer never sees it fall inside the hole. So the outside observer classically, literally sees everything piling up on the horizon. And the holographic hypothesis says that that's a semi-classical approximation to a quantum fact that there's some kind of quantum description in which all the information is encoded by unspecified but non-gravitational variables on the just outside the horizon of the black hole. Well, this is a pretty wacky idea. But if it's true, it's what we need to make progress with quark confinement. What was our problem with quark confinement? Well, quark confinement has nothing to do with gravity, and it's a question in four dimensions, where I'm counting time as one of the dimensions. So we've got three space and one time dimension, making four at all, and gravity isn't important. We just want to understand the behavior of quarks, which interact by forces that are much stronger than gravity, so much stronger that we will ignore gravity. We want to understand an ordinary theory, a gauge theory, without gravity in four dimensions. And Hough taught us in 1974 that if we ever wanted to understand how quarks behave, we would have to find that our gauge theory in four dimensions was equivalent to a string theory. But there's bad news that came with it. And the bad news is that this string theory would have gravity and it would be above four dimensions. Because string theory lives above four dimensions and it has gravity. The fact that string theory has gravity, well, physicists came to accept it only reluctantly after trying to get rid of that. So, because there was a preconception that string theory was for strong interactions, and it was ultimately visionaries, notably John Schwartz, who gave the concluding talk at our Strings 2001 meeting, Joel Shirk, and a few of their contemporaries, who finally recognized this. But at any rate, string theory is above four dimensions, and it does have gravity. So that sounds wrong for quarks and gluons. But here, to avoid the paradoxes of black holes, at Hooft and Susskind taught us something that also sounds wrong, but it sounds wrong in just the same way. They taught us that to avoid the paradoxes of black holes, a theory of gravity in bulk should be equivalent to a theory without gravity on the boundary of the black hole. So they tell us that two theories in different dimensions should be equivalent. The theory that has gravity in black holes in one dimension should be equivalent to a theory on the exterior, which has a lower dimension and is not supposed to have gravity. And reading it backwards to make sense out of quark confinement, we're supposed to interpret a theory without gravity, namely the theory of quarks and gluons, in four dimensions in terms of a theory with gravity, namely a string theory, above four dimensions. So the two stories are very similar. What we were told to do by Hooft and Susskind to avoid the contradictions of black holes is very similar to what Hooft had told us to do 20 years earlier to make sense out of quark confinement. So everything will work nicely if the holographic description, that is, the description of the gravitational theory by a theory on the boundary, is by an ordinary gauge theory. I know that gauge theories aren't so ordinary to all of you, not to those of you who don't work either on elementary particle physics or also on the geometry of four manifolds. But if you do work in elementary particle physics, gauge theory is ordinary theory. It's the bread and butter of the standard model of particle physics. And Hooft and Susskind said that a bulk theory with gravity was supposed to be equivalent to some unspecified theory on the boundary. Let's be optimists and assume that the unspecified theory is the same kind of theory that we use to describe the strongly interacting particles, that the boundary theory is a gauge theory. Then we'll have two descriptions of the same thing, a bulk description by a theory with gravity above four dimensions, and a boundary description by a gauge theory in four dimensions that lives on the boundary. So if holography would turn out to be true, and if the boundary theory would be an ordinary gauge theory, the kind of theory that we study to describe the usual particle forces other than gravity, then everything could work out nicely. Well, is holography true? The jury is still out in the case of an asymptotically flat spacetime. But in the case that the cosmological constant is negative, we've learned how to implement holography, and thereby we've learned, in certain situations, how to interpret the large n limit of a gauge theory as a string theory. Now, this development, where it was understood how to do holography when the cosmological constant is negative, is certainly one of the most exciting developments in string theory in the last several years. In fact, it was one of the main themes of talks presented at Strings 2001, as it has been at the Strings conferences since 1998, I think. A world with a negative cosmological constant has a very strange property. It's called anti-de Sitter space that baffled theoretical physicists for a long time. And reluctantly, people began to come to grips with it in the late 70s and early 80s. It has the strange property that there's a boundary at spatial infinity. And in a sense, you can communicate with that boundary. You can send a light wave that bounces to infinity and back in a finite length of time. What we've learned in the last few years, first of all, it was known since 1980 or so, through the work of Isham and others, that to make sense of physics in such a spacetime, one needs a boundary condition at spatial infinity. The results depend on the boundary condition, and the surprising discovery of the last few years is that by giving a time dependence to the boundary condition so that you emit and absorb signals from the boundary, we get a mapping of quantum gravity with negative curvature into conformal field theory on the boundary. Well, I don't have time to explain what conformal field theory is, so for today I want to say simply that conformal field theory means an ordinary gauge theory, the type of theory we use to describe particle physics. So this mapping finally gives us an example of what it Hoff told us in 1974 we were supposed to do. The theory with gravity, which is really a string theory, since in fact string theory is our only framework for making sense of quantum gravity, is equivalent to a gauge theory that describes the physics on the boundary. And in this mapping, we can transfer questions about gravity into questions about gauge theory, in some cases answering one question in terms of something that's more obvious on the other side. For example, the fact that the black hole is described by ordinary particle interactions is now more obvious. The fact that the black hole formation and evolution obeys the ordinary laws of quantum mechanics is now clear, given this mapping, because the boundary theory is a conventional quantum theory. And conversely, the confinement of quarks is mapped into a question about black holes, which can be answered by the Euclidean quantum gravity techniques that Hawking and Gibbons and Perry explored in the late 70s. Conveyed the notion that these two parallel lines of investigation, quark confinement and the exploration of quantum gravity and black holes, have merged through physicists discovering in the last few years, in large part through a brilliant insight by Maldacena, who gave the basic story of this duality, that these two pictures have come to converge, so that questions about quantum gravity are mapped into questions about gauge theory and the other way around, often answering one question or the other in terms of things that are more familiar on the other side. Now, the bad news here is that we can't, with current ideas, make this quantitative for the real theory of strong interactions. But nevertheless, I think it's a great breakthrough, because for the first time, we do understand large n limits of gauge theories in terms of string theories, which I believe, following at Hooft, is the natural scenario for understanding four-dimensional gauge theories. Anyway, this is the bad news. But the good news, I think, is just as important. The good news is that in trying to convey the unification of the ideas, I've only scratched the surface. Thank you.
We have time for just one or two very brief questions.
Ed, does holography give some indication as to what would replace the notion of space-time in quantum gravity?
Well, holography gives a radical answer, but not presumably a complete answer. Also, we don't really understand holography in general. We only understand it with this negative cosmological constant. Holography is a strange non-local mapping between a world with gravity in bulk to ordinary physics without gravity on the boundary. And it enables us to encode the information in a very strange way. The origin of the name holography is that an ordinary photo captures three-dimensional reality on two-dimensional paper in a way which is transparent. You can literally see the figure, but which loses much of the information, capturing only a two-dimensional projection of three-dimensional reality. A hologram, instead, is more subtle. I can't draw it because a hologram is unrecognizable. It gives a more complete representation of the three-dimensional reality on a two-dimensional surface, but it does so at the cost of the fact that the mapping is non-local and not very transparent. So there's something similar here. This holographic representation of the world with gravity, which has given us, I think, definitely one of our most exciting insights about quark confinement, is a non-local representation like the one in the hologram. And I think it's definitely a piece of the truth. But in January 2001, I don't think anybody's going to be able to answer your question. In this millennium, and presumably even in this century, as David said, but not in 2001, and certainly not in January 2001.
One more question, perhaps?
A slight physical question out here. I wanted to know, do laws of physics evolve? I mean, you're taking laws of physics as they are now, trying to understand them, and taking high energy reactions and probably going back in time. But what if the laws of physics are in fact changing? Are life forms evolve? I've heard particles evolve. But the laws of physics themselves evolve?
Well, I'm going to give you a purist answer. By definition, the laws of physics don't change, because the laws of physics describe the principles by which nature works. And our knowledge of the laws of physics is incomplete. And laws we don't yet know may have been important in the past and may be important in the future. But if so, I aim to discover them, and we will regard them as part of the laws of nature. What changes are not the laws of nature, but the physical conditions. The physical conditions were different in the past, and they are becoming different in the future as the universe expands and cools. And they may be changing in ways we don't know yet. For example, through a time dependence of fields that we perhaps haven't even discovered. Laws that were important in the past may not be as important today. Laws that, for example, laws that have not been important until now might be important in the future. But it's one physical reality, and whatever laws govern it have been true in the past and in the future, some effects being small under some conditions, some effects are small here at the Tata Institute and are big near the horizon of a black hole, and so on and so forth. But we aim, as scientists, to discover as comprehensive a description as we can of the natural world, and in that context, we'll aim to get a description of the laws once and for all, and to describe changes in reality is happening because the environment changes.
Let's thank Edward Witten for his talk.